Hello. Well, here in Britain, where I am recording this podcast in mid-May 2021, discussion of tariffs is the order of the day. So let's talk tariffs for a moment. The British government wants to sign a free trade deal with Australia, proving, so it hopes, that it can reach trade deals that don't just involve rolling over the privileges the country enjoyed as a member of the European Union. But what is a tariff? Well, very simply, it's a tax, a duty, an impost that a country imposes on the produce of another country. It's designed to bump up the price to the public of a good, either to raise revenue for the government or to protect local rivals from competition, or maybe both. These days, while manufactured goods mainly face very low tariffs, a similar effect to tariffs is achieved with regulations. But agricultural trade is still subject to significant barriers. Australia is demanding tariff-free access to the UK market for its agricultural products, a demand which, if conceded, opponents argue, may put small farmers, mainly in Wales and Scotland, out of business. The argument is that a farmer running a couple of hundred sheep on the Welsh hills or Scottish highlands can't compete on level terms with some mega farm on the other side of the world, where 8 of the 10 largest farms in the whole world are to be found. On the other hand, UK consumers like their meat, their wine, and so on, and they like it all the more if it's cheap. Back in the mercantilist 19th century, governments not only routinely erected very high barriers, but also imposed strict limits on what could be imported and how it could be transported. And the Americans were no exception. But being Americans, they did it bigger and better than anyone else. And so, in 1828, Congress agreed the Tariff of Abominations. And besides having an awesome name, this was supposed to protect manufacturing in the northern states by penalising imports from Britain. It did so by setting extremely high tariffs on British goods, like ridiculously high. These were set as high as they were, as an attempt to get Congress to vote down the bill. Instead, the cunning wheeze backfired. After some fun politicking, Congress actually passed the thing to the outrage of the Southerners, hence the name. And this came to have ramifications in the coming bank war that we're getting to, honest. A little further on, it led to a row called the Nullification Crisis, when South Carolina and the federal authorities had a standoff over the tariffs, with the state declaring the tariffs unconstitutional and therefore null and void. By this time, Andrew Jackson was president, and it was his vice president, John C. Calhoun, a South Carolina native, who dreamed up the idea of nullification, which was basically that federal writ ran only where the states allowed it to. This was, of course, a recipe for a constitutional crisis and another stepping stone on the path to the civil war that awaited some three decades down the line. In this case, South Carolina backed down after Jackson threatened war and some of the tariffs were reduced. Hello and welcome to the third and, you'll be pleased to hear, the final part of the series focusing on the booms, busts and various other shenanigans surrounding US attempts to install a central bank prior to the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. If you haven't listened to the other parts, it's probably worth going back and giving them a listen. However, briefly, this is where we are. The Second Bank of the United States, or BUS, received a 20-year charter in 1816, and it was in place to take the blame for the Panic of 1819 and the subsequent Depression, having first failed to rein in bank lending and then overcompensating, tightening credit too much and crashing the economy. Its president, a gentleman called Langdon Cheves, was booted out and replaced by Nicholas Biddle in 1822. In the 1824 presidential election, Andrew Jackson, running on a populist, anti-bank, anti-banker, anti-elite ticket, failed to get elected thanks to the quote-unquote corrupt bargain. He tried again 4 years later in 1828 and won in a landslide. But meanwhile, the US and the Brits were at each other's throats over trade. The British at the time were the workshop of the world, while the Americans fueled the British forges with their cotton. Cotton and all that went with it, especially chattel slavery, were the basis of the US economy at this time, even as the northern states were struggling to build up manufacturing capacity. The Americans wanted to protect their nascent industries from British competition, and they did so with tariffs on imports, a tariff war. Sound familiar? In 1830, Jackson came to an understanding, an arrangement, with the British. This was that while the tariffs stayed, each side agreed to treat goods arriving from the other as if they were their own. This, plus some clever financial engineering by Biddle that increased the amount of credit in the economy, boosted trade enormously. Imports and exports both surged. Biddle's new financial instruments allowed American importers to buy vast quantities of British goods on credit. In 1832, with a presidential election due at the end of the year, Biddle decided to ask for early renewal of the BUS Charter. This might have seemed rash at the time because Jackson and Biddle, and by extension the BUS, had gone to war with each other the previous year. However, by this point, the bank seemed to have overcome most of the obstacles to its continued existence. The Supreme Court had deemed it constitutional, ending efforts by hostile states to tax it or close it down. It was doing a decent job in its services to the Treasury and was enforcing a uniform value for the dollar. Except the president hated it and hated Biddle, and there was that presidential election coming up in 1832. Jackson was concerned that the bank would use its influence to tilt the election against him. Another group that was also hostile to the BUS was the swelling constituency of state banks that didn't like federal regulation, which was actually part of the point of the BUS. In a piece published in the Journal of Economic History, Bray Hammond points out, quote, between 1801 and 1829, their number, he's referring to the number of state chartered banks, their number had greatly increased, as had the volume of their business and the demand for credit. The records indicate that in 1801 there were 31 banks, in 1829 there were 329, and in 1837 there were 788, an increase of 140% during Jackson's administration alone. Hammond goes on to note that in his first annual address to Congress, Jackson had said, quote, both the constitutionality and the expediency of the law creating the bank were well questioned by a large portion of our fellow citizens, and it must be admitted by all that it has failed in the great end of establishing a uniform and sound currency, end quote. Yeah, this really wasn't true. And it seems that what Jackson meant by it was that money isn't really money, uniform and sound, if it doesn't jingle in the owner's pockets. Hard money, gold and silver, was where it was at for Jackson and his agrarian backers. Not these newfangled notes people were trying to fob them off with. We'll come back to that. In 1831, the year the majorly nearsighted Major Thomas Biddle got himself killed in a duel, and as Jackson's bid for a second term loomed the following year, Jackson and Biddle fell out big time. Concerned, as we've said, that the BUS might use its financial clout to hurt him electorally, in February 1831, Jackson's newspaper allies went on the offensive against Biddle. That prompted Biddle to do some influencing of his own in an effort to get the rechartering through. He chose to act through a lobbyist called Silas Burroughs, whom he sent off to New York. There, Burroughs, described as a, quote, strange and erratic merchant, end quote, by Thomas Govan, Biddle's biographer, managed to persuade a young newspaper editor called James Watson Webb to support the rechartering. Webb was a member of Jackson's inner circle, but was very ambitious and successful, and eager to expand his title. The expansion was costly, but Burroughs had an answer. This boiled down to a secret loan from the BUS that was kept off the books. The background to this was complex, and according to Govan, the whole thing was basically unnecessary, making a legitimate business decision look like a subterfuge. Of course, the loan and Burroughs came back to bite the bank and Biddle. That's because the affair came to light, and a bank making off-the-books loans to newspapers in the run-up to an election just doesn't look good, especially not to an incumbent running for re-election who is at odds with the bank making the loans. What happened was that another newspaper editor, John Mumford of the New York Standard, popped up and accused Burroughs of offering a loan in exchange for supporting the recharter, a loan that he, of course, had virtuously refused. No one believed that Mumford had said no to a loan, but Burroughs basically admitted to Biddle that he had indeed offered money to Webb in exchange for support. Efforts by Biddle to have Burroughs state he had not been authorised to do any such thing did nothing to repair the damage. As H.W. Brands reports in his book, The Money Men, Capitalism, Democracy, and the 100 Years' War over the American Dollar, Jackson had decided, quote, "The bank is trying to kill me, but I will kill it," end quote. So, in 1832, when Congress began to consider rechartering the BUS, Jackson reacted by setting out a series of demands for changes in what the bank could and couldn't do. BUS opponents also opened an investigation into supposed misconduct and violation of the charter. Jackson opposed taking any action on rechartering until that investigation was complete. Biddle's decision to push for a renewal of the charter ahead of time was not clever. And actually, it was an illustration of the maxim that being highly intelligent is not the same as being wise, because the renewal, or otherwise, of the BUS's charter became a central issue in the election of 1832. The newspaper affair had handled Biddle's enemies a weapon to use against him in support of their accusation that he was attempting to influence the election. None of this had anything to do with the rechartering of the BUS, nor of its usefulness, but it strengthened the hand of its opponents in confirming the fears of ordinary citizens that they were being manipulated by an elite using the BUS for its own purposes. That was Jackson's pitch, too, and he was re-elected in a landslide. That allowed Jackson to veto the rechartering and do as he had threatened, destroy the Second Bank of the US. In May 1833, Jackson instructed Treasury Secretary Louis McLean to remove its deposits from the BUS. The secretary refused and was fired. He was replaced with William Duane. He also refused to do as he was told and was fired too. Finally, Duane was replaced by Robert Taney, who in September actually carried out the instruction. I mean, you'd have thought that Jackson would have asked these people if they were prepared to do as he told them before he appointed them, but, you know, who am I? The money was put into a bunch of state banks, derisively dubbed pet banks. The move had the foreseeable consequence of causing the number of banks in the US to soar, and the tally rose to 829 by 1838. Between October and December 1833, short-term rates rose to 10%, and then in 1834, climbed from 15% to 34%, as markets came to doubt the wisdom of firing two Treasury secretaries and then putting the nation's money into some friendly banks. Moreover, those friendly banks had reacted to the influx of government cash by going on a lending spree. This quickly ran out of control, arguably because the Bank of the US was no longer present to rein the state banks in. This view was once received wisdom. It makes sense intuitively, after all, in that the punch bowl is left sitting on the table for the revellers to enjoy. But it has recently become more controversial. Some people prefer to look at the effect of international transactions and money flowing in and out of the country instead. But adding to all this was the very healthy-looking state of the government's finances. The boom in trade from Jackson's arrangement with Britain, combined with the hefty income from the tariffs, meant that the federal government was able to repay all its debts and then distribute money to the states. A credit boom and the accompanying inflation, including in the price of land, in the price of slaves, in the price of all hard assets, that resulted. Money was cheap and plentiful, and when money is cheap and plentiful, borrowers are plentiful too, eager to grab the newly minted notes of the state-chartered banks. This had actually some linguistic repercussions. The paper floating about in this period gave rise to expressions that are still with us today. In his book, A Nation of Deadbeats, Scott Reynolds Nelson reports that the $10 notes issued by the Citizens Bank of Louisiana were labelled in both English and French, and that is 10 and 10, dix to an English speaker. These notes were widely used in the area north of New Orleans and south of the Ohio River, and steamboat captains began to call the area Dixieland. He also notes a fun origin for the term flying a kite. This was used to refer to borrowers repaying their notes with new notes. This was common practice in what Nelson calls the cotton credit chain. This was the system that meshed cotton producers in the US South with textile manufacturers in Britain via the ports of New Orleans and Liverpool. That was in one direction. Finished goods, principally textiles, then departed Liverpool, bound for New Orleans and other American ports. The issue is how to pay for something when seller and buyer are separated by several thousand miles of ocean. The answer was a system, a network, a chain of credit that relied on a group of intermediaries borrowing in England at 2 to 3% and lending in the US at 8% or more. Moreover, a whole series of other commodities depended on the state of the cotton market because when times were good, plantation owners planted all their land with cotton and bought everything else. As Nelson points out, flour, bacon, and clothing depended on stability in the cotton market. Enter first the Coinage Act of 1834. This tweaked the relative values of gold and silver, overvaluing gold a little and undervaluing silver a little, in the hope that silver standard countries such as France and Prussia would buy the silver, while gold would flow in from countries like Britain that were using that standard. The aim, according to Nelson, on whom I am leaning for this section, was to make gold more popular than the notes issued by dodgy banks, including the BUS, and it worked for a while. In June 1836 came the Distribution Act. This instructed the Treasury to deposit $28 million with the pet banks. These were classed as quote-unquote low-interest loans. And there were a fair number of pet banks, many of them new, 110 in 1836 alone, and without much experience in prudent banking. Cue faster expansion of the highly levered speculative bubble that had already developed in land sales. Add to that vast mortgages on land and, of course, slaves. Nelson reports that in 1830, a prime male slave cost $500 in New Orleans, rising to more than $700 in 1835 as the cotton trade boomed, and then to $1,250 2 years later. Slaves were more valuable in the cotton fields of the Deep South than further east, and as the differential increased, more and more were sold down the river to Louisiana and Mississippi from Virginia and South Carolina. And then there was railroad building. Lots of railroads. Lots and lots of railroads. The following month, July, came the Specie Circular. This was an attempt to rein in the burgeoning land speculation, whereby people were paying for federal land with depreciating banknotes, and then using the land as collateral, overvaluing it, of course, to borrow more. Lather, rinse, repeat. The circular was an executive order that required all land bought from the government to be paid for with hard currency, gold or silver. The result was a sudden pressing need for hard currency on the part of anyone with debts outstanding to the government. The result was forced sales of slaves, cotton, and of land as people raised cash to meet their obligations. And the result of that was plunging commodity prices, devalued bank paper, and an almighty depression. The banks and other finance companies that had lent against these assets as collateral found that they were about to become owners of, among much else, vast numbers of slaves. To prevent the banks from taking possession of their slaves, the defaulting slave owners headed for the safety of the independent Republic of Texas, which wasn't yet part of the US. The Texan government, which was eager to stock up with white settlers, encouraged the process. All this was combining with another process taking place across the Atlantic. This was at the Bank of England, which was looking at its shrinking gold reserves and pointing the finger at the Coinage Act, which was incentivizing people to sell gold from its vaults to American vaults. In 1836, the BOE reacted by raising its rate of interest, bank rate, to 4.5% from 4%, boosting the cost of borrowing for the intermediaries that were oiling the wheels of the cotton chain of credit. Then doubts emerged about the real value of the notes drawn on American banks that were held by British ones, which sent the US money market into a tailspin. This is Nelson. From August to December, the money market in the United States went crazy, with rates as high as 24% in August and September, and 36% in October. The price of cotton dropped 30% to 40%, end quote. And that just wasn't supposed to happen, but it did. Anyone needing to borrow, i.e. all of the US merchants, all of the cotton chain of credit, was in a complete mess. Added to that, the whole system of import-export finance was levered to the price of cotton. If that fell far enough, the sale price of the cotton wouldn't cover the cost of the shipping and the money advanced against it. The various intermediaries and other actors in the cotton chain of credit would still be liable for the full value of the notes they had used to pay each other, as would others who had countersigned those notes. And then, just to prove that things that are bad can also actually get worse, the price of wheat soared, in part because the crop had been damaged by the Hessian fly, aka Meitiola destructor, an insect pest that feeds on cereal crops. The result was food riots. By 1837, Jackson was out of the presidency, replaced by Martin Van Buren, who had to handle the depression that had ensued. So, in line with the basic thinking of the 19th century elite, he did pretty much nothing, allowing the misery to rip through the population. Nice. In 1837, the bank suspended specie payments. This is a feature of a metallic standard. It means that the promise that banknotes feature, I promise to pay the bearer some sum of hard money in exchange for their bit of paper, was no longer valid. Basically, the banks didn't have much hard cash, and any they did have, they were going to hang on to. The suspension lasted, with minor interruptions, until 1842. The economic fallout of the panic has been compared to the Great Depression of the 1930s. According to a paper by John Joseph Wallace for the National Bureau of Economic Research, quote, prices fluctuated as rapidly then as in any other period in the nation's history. The deflation from 1839 to 1843 rivals the decline from 1929 to 1933. And the sharp drops in 1837 and 1839 are as large as any other single year declines. End quote. The dislocation was actually a two-part affair. There was the panic of 1837 and the subsequent deflation, followed by the crisis of 1839 and depression. The results were far-reaching. Here's Wallace again. The crisis that began in 1839 ultimately led nine state governments to default on their debts in 1841 and 1842. Stimulated by the crisis, the debate over the appropriate relationship between the state and the economy ultimately produced a wave of constitutional reforms. Beginning with New York in 1846, almost two-thirds of the states wrote new constitutions in the next 10 years. The new constitutions restricted state investment in private corporations, limited or banned incorporation by special legislative acts, created general incorporation laws for all types of business, altered the way state and local governments issued debt, put absolute limits on the amount of debt governments could issue, and fundamentally changed the structure of the property tax. These changes were intended to remedy weaknesses in state and local government revealed during the crisis following 1839. End quote. Another casualty of the period was the Second Bank of the United States, which, after losing its federal charter thanks to Jackson's veto, had been rechartered as a Pennsylvanian bank. An attempt to corner the cotton market in 1839 went wrong and was partly to blame for the bank closing its doors for the final time in 1841. The other part of the responsibility lies with the portfolio of state bonds and bank stocks it acquired after it was rechartered in Pennsylvania. Wallace argues that the panic of 1837 hit banks in the northeast of the country and in New Orleans hardest. Basically, these were the commercial centres. 2 years later, the institutions that were in trouble were in the South and West, and their problems were the result of their close links to state governments. The states had spent the first part of the 1830s borrowing like mad to build railways, canals, bridges, and so on, and were overextended. They had borrowed too much to invest in projects of too doubtful value. When Mississippi decided to stop paying its notes, it had all of 42 cents in the treasury, according to Nelson. I haven't checked that figure, as it's just too delicious. But still, that state's repudiation of its debts shocked outsiders and prompted concern that Britain might send in the gunboats to recover what its citizens were owed. Those were the days. That didn't happen, but the debts of the delinquent states remained a sore point for years. The states had started to feel the pain in 1837 when interest rates soared and credit crunched, although the defaults didn't occur until 3 or 4 years later. The financial troubles at state level fed through to the banks, but that's a different story and not one I'm going to take on in this piece. Author Herman Melville's family was ruined in the Panic of 1837. His famous work, Moby Dick, could be read as an allegory of the bank wars, Scott Reynolds Nelson suggests. The Great White Whale may be seen as the BUS and its enemy, Captain Ahab, as President Andrew Jackson. The battle between the two, between Ahab and the whale, and between Jackson, the BUS, and Nicholas Biddle, ended by consuming them all, with none of the participants able to claim victory, all of them destroyed. Well, that's just one of the allegorical meanings that can be read into the Great American Novel, which apparently sold 3,200 copies in the author's lifetime. But prosaic though that allegory is, it's as good as any other. We'll stop there. Thank you for listening. Do stay subscribed, if such you are, because the Boom and Bust podcast will be back. If you are not subscribed, well, please do. And rate and review the show on whichever platform you see fit to cast your pods. Music today was, as ever, All This Time by guitar maestro Clive Carroll from his album Life in Colour. Thanks once again for listening and...